We have a guest related to the so-called pop-up museum phenomenon.
Great.
Which we've been talking. Yeah, we're always ready. Maybe if you took off your sunglasses, you'd see we're ready. We have coming in. Hello. Excuse me for not getting up, but I'm Tom. This is Toby Jacoby, a team member of the Prison Public Memory Project. You want to sit there? There are some headphones. And hold on a second. Right to the mic. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
We've been talking about the phenomenon of house concerts or exhibitions that just seem to come out of nowhere.
Ellen used to call them pop-up museums, but she was, pop-up exhibits and museums, but she was chastised by our own Sam Sebring.
I never found out the reason why, but.
You know Sam, right?
I don't.
Oh, I think he was over there earlier today. But anyway, do you object to that? Do you have a pop-up museum?
Well, I don't actually object to that.
When I started
doing some research on the kind of event we wanted to have, mm-hmm. I found that there were pop-up museums popping up everywhere around the country. The Santa Cruz, California Museum has a wonderful series of pop-up museums, and they use that term without any apology.
It's a way to go into the community and be better known and to have participation by members of the community bringing their own objects too, isn't that part of the scheme?
I do think it's part of the scheme, and one of the things that the motto that we're using today is blowing the dust off history, so that we're trying to
because I went by and I just saw blowing off the dust and I was like, what's that? It's like they sell them vacuum cleaners or something?
Yeah, no vacuum cleaners. Just
so let's make it clear, you're in the 7th Street Park here in Hudson. How long are you going to be there?
We're here till 7 o'clock tonight.
Just today.
And then we're going to pop up twice more here in Hudson this month. So we'll over in the library next Tuesday.
Indoors.
Outdoors. Right outside the library from 10 till 7 next Tuesday.
Tuesday.
I think that's the 14th.
10 to 7 on the
14th. That's in Hudson, folks.
Yes.
We're talking
and
about
then
Hudson.
The next time?
And then the following week on Thursday, I believe that's the 23rd, will be by Promenade Park.
Oh, okay. Also 10 to 7?
10 to 7.
So describe your museum a little bit for listeners who might, want to come.
Sure. So we have a couple of components that people can come and get to know. We, a couple of years ago, were privy to a box that was found by a local business owner, Lisa Durfee. And so we call it the Durfee Box. And so we're highlighting some of the history from the Hudson Training School for Girls.
The box was all material related
to all materials, fragmentary materials from the 1920s and 30s primarily.
By someone who worked there or had been there?
She found it at a garage sale.
So she's not
tucked under a table. So we don't know exactly who gathered these materials. There are fragments of letters, there are photographs, postcards, intake forms, social histories. It's a really fascinating.
So it's not like just one person or one.
There were 18 girls represented.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, it's been really fun and fascinating to get to know
them. And, of course, you'll want to tell our listeners who was the most famous girl who was incarcerated there.
Absolutely. So that was a little bit later than the Durfee Box. That was in the 30s, but we have Ella Fitzgerald. So if anyone wants to know a little bit more about the hidden history, a little piece of Ella Fitzgerald's hidden history, you can come and look, and we have an artifact that shows her logbook entry.
Wow. And what we didn't mention is that we're talking about the prison, which is now over here on between 3rd and Worth. It's now
a medium security men's facility.
Now, have you been able to get in there to see some of the old buildings?
I haven't. I was able to just drive up to the very front of the buildings about a year and a half ago.
They really not interested in cooperating with this project? Or
No, I don't think that's the case at all. We've just been slowly organizing and developing a relationship with them. And so we're actually going to go, we hope sometime in the next 6 months, and do some workshops with the men who currently reside there, working with some of the documents.
And when you say we, who again is the we?
So there's a team of folks. Tracy Huling is the founder and director of the project. And then there are local folks here. I'm actually from Colorado State University in Fort Collins.
And what's the name?
What the heck are you doing here?
I am a literacy scholar by trade. And so I do community work, and I actually work with currently incarcerated writers. And I, you know, here's where social media never leaves our lives. I saw something on Facebook a few years ago that announced the discovery of this box, and I was really fascinated by it.
Yeah.
There's also a local scholar, Laura Rogers, who works up in Albany, and so we've been working together.
So it's called the Prison Public
Memory Project.
Now,
I seem to recall at one point they were also collecting oral histories, right?
They are. In fact, they're collecting them right now in the park.
What do you mean? There are people who worked there or were incarcerated there?
Part of what we're doing is trying to, as that motto said, dust off people's memories and give people a chance to look at these materials from the 1920s. But then we have another tent where people can share a story. So earlier today, for example, someone came up and he said, I don't have a lot of time, but I remember playing in the fields up in at the training school. And I would go and we'd play football and baseball. And if you got a ball into the orchard, you had to climb over the razor wire in order to get it back. And I still have a scar on my knee to show it.
And by the field, did he mean the part that you get into from Worth Avenue?
I think so.
Yeah. My hood.
I think so.
Mm-hmm. I live across the street from that entrance.
We've also had lots of people come and tell stories about having a grandparent or a parent who worked there.
Mm. Now, did it cease being... Sorry, Ellen.
I was just going to say, speaking of working there, that box, the contents of that box sounds to me like it may be somebody who worked there.
That's what we suspect.
And when the place closed down and all of this
stuff... Have you been watching CSI?
All of this material, they might have said, oh, let's just throw it out. They captured some of it, maybe, or didn't get it into the archives.
And
maybe there are archives in the state someplace, in the state library.
There are quite a few archives. So we've also been, the Durfee Box materials are complemented by a lot of materials we've been able to find up at both the state library and the state archive.
To get some of the facts on the record here, when did it open and when did it cease being a young woman's...
So the history of the buildings themselves is a fascinating one.
Uh-huh.
It first opened in the late 1800s as the Women's House of Refuge. And that served women who were anywhere from maybe 16 on up. And then in 1904, the state just decided to translate it into a juvenile facility. So that's when it became the New York State Training School for Girls. And that was open from 1904 to 1975.
Oh, 75. Wow.
That was for girls who were ages 12 to 16.
12 to 16. So they would be sent there from juvenile court, that kind of thing? I mean, was it mandatory? How did that usually work?
Well, they were sent for lots of reasons. If you look at some of the logbook entries that we have at the exhibit, there are things like ungovernable child, delinquent child, truancy. But there were really lots of reasons. So if you look at the 1904 guidebook that was put out for magistrates and parents and the public, it says things like frequenting dance saloons. My favorite line is that you could be sent there for collecting and peddling cigar stubs.
Ooh.
So there's
You're lucky, Ellen. You're lucky you didn't get sent there.
I've never heard of that as an occupation.
There were also kids whose parents couldn't provide for them or who were also in trouble with the law or who were just simply poor.
Why was Ella sent there?
She was sent there, according to her logbook entry, for being an ungovernable child and not listening to, says something like, the just words of her father, rules of her father, something like that.
And what were conditions like? Was it a brutal place? Was it a decent place? I mean...
You know, it really depends on who you talk to. For some, it was sort of a place of refuge. And for others, there was a lot of segregation that happened through the 30s. For others, it was not a very kind place to live. Typically, girls would be there for a couple of years. There were classes they took. There were different kinds of vocational training, and then they were often sent out into the world and placed, for example, with as domestic labor in a home. One of the ways that girls left the school was by getting married, and so often there were girls there who would marry rather young so they could...
Prison guards.
So they could get out. I'm not sure about that.
Yeah. I mean, how... Well, yeah. The staff was both men and women, or primarily women?
I don't know the answer to that question. I know that some of the superintendents have been men in the past. My focus has mainly been in the 1920s. And so I've gotten to know the girls' stories, but I'm not sure across that 70-year history what the ratio of gender was like.
Yeah.
It's really pretty interesting.
So it is. Do you see that? I mean, how do you conceptualize this as part of something beyond just the story? I mean, do you think of it as like telling something about, say, prison life in the 20th century or the 19th and 20th century? I mean, or do you just kind of, I mean, it's more than antiquarianism, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think the work of doing public history is, part of it is recovery work and public memory work and kind of dusting things off. But then there's also a hope that a real connection can be made and, you know, starting conversations that will hopefully lead to us reflecting on the present conditions as well.
Mm-hmm. For example, has anybody and like any scholars approached you about using this material for some kind of, you know, book or something like that?
Well, I'm a scholar.
Okay.
And so I've been working with my partner, Laura Rogers, and I are thinking, we were just talking today about what some kind of book project might look like.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's also a lot of value in thinking about not just the scholarly side of thing, but also how we might present this in different ways to the public for consumption.
Right, and that's certainly the museum aspect of it.
The museum aspect of it, and I think there's also some opportunities to do some art making around it, and I know that the Prison Public Memory Project is partnering with a series of events. I think it's called Slow Justice, and that'll be announced for the fall. So one of the ideas that we've talked about are taking some of the current documents that we have, old postcards or letters, and taking those into different community groups, both in and outside of prisons, and kind of remaking them into something that will have a different kind of message.
You know, there's one of the big warehouse buildings here is called the Pocketbook Factory, and there are people living here who used to work there and remember it very well. And there's a choreographer whose name I can't remember right now who put together a dance utilizing these people and their jobs, like the man who used to sweep the floor at the end of the day, clean up the debris, and you know, use those movements and put them actually into a dance with some professional dancers. And it was done in the Pocketbook Factory. It was quite wonderful.
I think there's
a lot that can be done with turning memory into something else.
It really feels like a documentary should be made about this particular institution because it does have such a storied history.
Yeah, and I guess it's important. I mean, I was trying to press you a little bit because, I agree, dusting off all the debris just to get it what was there is important. But I'm also curious, you know, how eventually to conceptualize what you have there. You know what I mean? What does it amount to? Mm-hmm. Turning it into other art is interesting, but, you know, it seems to me that it'd be also worthwhile to be historical about it, you know what I mean, in terms of a narrative history of what actually happens.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what does
it
mean?
It feels like historians...
Is it a negative moment in American history, you know, that kind of thing? Or is it... Mm-hmm. Did it have some value, you think?
Well, I think it's... To me, it feels more complicated than saying it was valuable or it had a negative impact. I think it had both.
Right.
So, you know, today when we think about the U.S. prison population, we have merged many different kinds of institutions that we used to have in this country. So mental health, substance abuse, criminal offenses, they're kind of all housed in our prison system now. And so there was a need for these children to be supported and helped, And that need was met for some well by the training school, mm-hmm. and then for others, Ella Fitzgerald never spoke about her time at the training school. It wasn't a part of her history that she had any desire to share publicly. And so it was only after, I think, quite a bit after her death that mm-hmm. it even became public. So I do think there's a value in pressing people to use history to reflect on the current state of affairs.
Yeah, no, I read not too long ago, a really excellent book called A Pickpocket's Tale. I don't know if you know the book, but Timothy Guilfoyle. And it's about 19th century criminal justice and the prison system in the 19th century. And it begins with the so-called pickpocket. And the historian discovered a memoir in the Columbia Rare Book Room. And that's what started it. Mm-hmm. But in the course of that book, you learn that exactly what you were saying about how prisons were they were conceived very differently. In fact, he was originally sent in more as a troubled child whose parents had abandoned him. So it wasn't really a prison in that sense, but it was all very jumbled together. And he, of course, ended up in the prison system, eventually at Sing Sing and Dannemora and all those places. But so it's an interesting story during that period, how young people in particular were treated in a way that we would frown upon today. Although, you know, we have this prison of right over here for young males.
Oh, right.
Which I hear is a pretty rough scene.
Is it Boxwood?
I think that's what it's called,
Brookwood.
Brookwood.
And Brookwood Retention Center, is it called? I'm not sure exactly.
I know somebody who works there, and apparently, I mean, these are very violent young people.
Yeah, and they... But break out every now and then.
Yeah.
You know, it's an interesting contradiction, I think, happening in our society right now, because a lot of what people know about the prison system, they're taking from experiences like watching Orange is the New Black. And then we have opportunities like the Prison Public Memory Project, which is trying to really counter some of those fixed stereotypes. And so if we can find some middle ground between what people think of as dusty history and sensational media, I think there's an opportunity.
I saw one episode of it. Didn't interest me. But what's the critique of that show in terms of people who are more knowledgeable about the prison system?
Thinking about women in prison is actually my area of study, and so it's been really fascinating for me to think about, because in some ways it has brought public attention to this population which largely gets forgotten. On the other hand, it's also brought a lot of attention to same-sex relationships, to the idea of transgendered identities. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it has really tried to fix certain stereotypes in ways that, if you don't have a critical viewing of the show, can reproduce stereotypes that aren't really that useful. There are also some websites that are really unhappy with the way race has been represented on the show. I think it's gotten a little more critical as the different seasons have developed.
You're a big fan of that show, right, Ellen?
I've never seen it.
I knew that.
But I was thinking of The Wire, because there's a lot of
there was one season with
prison life there.
Yeah, that really focused on the prison.
Yeah.
I couldn't watch that one. It was a little too violent for me.
It's a great scene.
Yeah, you have to get past the violence in that
series. It's a great scene where the writer Richard Price is teaching The Great Gatsby to one of the characters in a prison class.
In a prison class?
Yeah.
I remember that.
It's pretty interesting. It's a good scene. Anyway. Well, we're speaking to Toby Jacoby, nice rhyming name. She is a team member of the Prison Public Memory Project. So is that project just the name for here, or is that something that's going on all across the country?
It's, according to the director, Tracy Huling, it starts here in Hudson. So we started with the Hudson Correctional Facility and its history, and they're hoping to do work with other prisons and correctional facilities across the country. I believe their next project will be with Coxsackie and Green Correctional Facility.
Yeah.
So,
are you?
I believe that's the maximum security prison over there.
I think so.
Yeah.
Is this organization connected at all to the...
Prison Voices?
No, the... Well, yeah, Prison Voices, but also Oral History Summer School that's here every year. Somehow I get
I think there was a little bit of...
There was a connection at one point in terms of, you know, learning how to do the oral histories and all that kind of thing.
Right, exactly.
It's incredibly fascinating. I mean, you read about the history of Sing Sing, the history of Dannemora. They're all incredible. And, of course, now upstate New York seems to thrive on this ridiculous, I wouldn't call it an industry because it's not industrial. It's just...
No, but when they try to pull the prison out of Hudson,
the one we're talking about.
A lot of people that, you know, depend on it for work. I mean, it's always been a good industry for Hudson and for other places.
Oh, I don't think it really helped us. I don't think we benefit from it that much.
No, you benefit from the population being here because somehow there's something about when you go for grants and you have to count the population.
Really?
Yeah,
I thought they were taking them out of that. That was why they're no longer counted in the...
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, prisoners in New York State are now counted
when it comes
to voting from their home address rather than this address.
Right.
And some of them actually don't have home addresses. You know, they don't know what to write down as a home address. So it's difficult.
We've certainly heard a lot about employees over the last 6 hours or so as we've been camped out over there in the park. We've had many people come up to us and say that they had parents who worked there or grandparents who worked there. So that's been fascinating to hear about.
What I'm wondering is if any of the people who were incarcerated there, if that's the word that's used in this instance, ever settled in Hudson. Because I'm told that some of the African-American, I don't know if this is true or not, people who are here.
Are you spreading rumors again, Ellen?
I shouldn't say it because I don't know if it's even true. That people have settled here because they come to visit someone at the correctional facility and they decide this is a nice place, so they move here. I don't know if that's true.
I don't know the answer to that. I do know that that the project is actively inviting people to come in. And
what was when it was the girls' reformatory, if you want to call it that? What was the capacity for? I dare call them inmates. I don't know what would you call them.
There's some controversy over using words like reformatory, prison, and that kind of changed over a 70-year history. Mm-hmm. So they definitely use training school in the beginning, and I'm not as familiar with the later years, so I'm not sure what term was preferable. And so they called them girls.
Girl, okay.
In a lot of the literature. Rather than...
And how many maximum were there?
So in the early days, I believe there were more. So it ranged from 150 to about 350.
Oh, wow.
At its maximum.
Just far more than the prison population there now.
I believe so.
Oh, yeah, much more. That's one of the reasons people want to see a state often thinks about closing it. It's not really as many prisons. You know, prison population, we learned that it's gone up, but there's been so many prisons constructed that a lot of them are... not functioning at full capacity. Because, you know, that was a way to stimulate the economy, they say.
Right.
And it does especially feel like there's a turn in the last couple of years to helping people reintegrate into communities.
Right.
Well, there has to be. Well, once again, we've been talking to Toby Jacoby, and we want to thank her for coming in right off the street here, which probably would have got her...
She just popped up.
Which probably would have gotten her sent to that girls' school back then. You can't just pop in off the street. Toby Jacoby, who's a team member of the Prison Public Memory Project, and they'll be there for two more hours, right?
Absolutely.
So come on into the 7th Street Park, and if you miss that, they will pop up twice more on the 14th of July at the Hudson Library from 10 to 7, 10 in the morning to 7 in the evening, and then on Thursday the 23rd down at Promenade Hill. How do you say it? Promenade or promenade?
Promenade.
Oh, aren't you fancy? Okay, Promenade Hill.
Promenade, I think, is...
Lemonade? What?
It's like walking.
Oh.
Maybe.
Well, that's, I think, where the word comes from.
I'm not at all sure.
Anyway, that one's on the that one's on the 23rd from 10 to 7.
And you can also find us on Facebook, and we have a website
Ellen's
with
a big
an
Facebook
active
user,
blog.
Right?
So you can find out lots more information.
You're talking
about
two people
events
who don't use Facebook. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, I bet lots of your listeners do use
I
Facebook.
That's true.
You're making a bet that there are lots of listeners. But anyway.
Absolutely.
We only know of 38 for sure. Toby, thank you
so much
for
coming in. Yeah.
Absolutely.
We're so lucky that you showed up.
I'm so pleased to have been able to come
and
talk
had something
with you.
To say.
It was Tom's idea. He looked across.
Thank you, Ellen.
And said, we'll send our
we'll send Cheryl out there.
We'll send our outreach director.
Right. To outreach. To go reach out.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. That was great. Thank you for coming in.